Application Academy is closing if you are applying to medical school in 2024 to start in 2025. We are closing in mid-April, April 12th or 13th, somewhere around there, somewhere in mid-April. We're closing our door. It's time for you to get in to Application Academy to get the support you need to put together your story so that you aren't one of those students that end up rejected because you didn't know how to tell your story. Come join us at applicationacademy.com. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. I'll see you soon at applicationacademy.com. The pre-med path can be super confusing. If you'd love some help on your path or on your applications, use the promo code PMY for pre-med years, PMY, over at medicalschoolhq.net and get some help from some of our experts, former directors of admissions, admissions officers, other experts. We have a small team ready to help you today. Again, that's promo code PMY to get a discount on our services at medicalschoolhq.net. The pre-med year, session number 501. Hello, and welcome to The Pre-Med Years, where we believe that collaboration, not competition, is key to your success. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Gray, and in this podcast, we share with you stories, encouragement, and information that you need to know to help guide you on your path to becoming a physician. And welcome to The Pre-Med Years. Thank you so much for joining me today. I have an amazing guest, someone who has seen all aspects of the pre-med and med student journey. Today, we're talking to MAPS VP of Academic Advising, Dr. Scott Wright, who has been the Director of Admissions at UT Southwestern, then moved to the pre-med side as the Dean at UT Dallas, running the pre-health advising office there, and then moving finally to TMDSAS, the whole application system, the first application system to medical schools here in the U.S. For all Texas medical schools, almost all of them, most public schools, all public schools, and Baylor now as well. So Dr. Scott Wright is going to join us, talk about his thoughts on being a pre-med student, what you should be doing, how you can quote-unquote stand out, or can you, and so much more. Dr. Scott Wright is a wealth of knowledge. You get to hear him every week on Ask Mapped as well when we do our live stream Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern. You can hear Dr. Scott Wright sharing his wisdom. And if you're interested in working with Dr. Wright one-on-one, you can do that as well. Check it out at mapped.com. So without further ado, let's go and jump in. Say hello to Scott. Dr. Scott Wright, how you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you.
Quote, air quotes there.
Yes.
Good to see you, Ryan.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for coming on the pre-med years.
Yeah, of course.
You have been an advisor now, the VP of Academic Advising at MAPT now for over 2 years, I think, maybe.
Crazy. Yeah.
If we count. Yeah. Who's counting? And I figured I don't know why we haven't brought you on before, but here we are to kind of talk some academic philosophy, some advising philosophy, to share all of the secrets that you hold to TMDSAS, because you're the retired executive director of TMDSAS. Yeah. So everyone listening is going to be in store for a legend of the pre-med and med student world today.
Whatever. I don't know if I can live up to that.
I know you can, which is why I'm going to put all the pressure on you today. Let's get started. How does one become interested? You are, I introduce you as Dr. Scott Wright. You are not a MD or DO in the doctor sense, but an education doctor. How does one get involved to say, you know what, when I grow up, I want to be a dream crusher for students applying to medical school and go be the director of admissions at a medical school and just crush everyone's dreams?
I think it is like many things in life. It was circumstantial. It was incredibly circuitous route. It was happenstance. I was I did my undergrad in history, and I did a master's degree in history. I was on the trajectory to be a history professor, was what I wanted to do. And as I, through some circumstances and things, it became clear to me that that's really not what I wanted to do. But I really loved the academic environment. And so I went back to graduate school to do a doctorate in education and to be in the space of the scholastic world and I had a background in college admissions. And so what happened was right at the time when I was going back to graduate school, I UT Southwestern Medical School in Dallas was redesigning their admissions process and needed a director of admissions. And the stars aligned and everything happened. And I knew admissions. I didn't know squat about medical education, but I knew how to run a process and how to create a process. And so it just kind of worked out for me to go there. And 10 years into it, I was, doing the admissions thing at Southwestern, and things just kind of played out after that. But yeah, that's kind of how I ended up doing admissions work in the medical education world. And so, I what I've always taken away from that, Ryan, is that we always have to be prepared for whatever comes our way in life. And you have to be prepared emotionally, you have to be prepared experientially, you have to be prepared educationally. And if you're prepared, then you are ready to take on whatever opportunities come your way or exist that seem to align with your mission. And so that's a great lesson, I think, for students, is to prepare yourself. And that's what they're doing really for when they're in college, when they're in a post-bac program or whatever. It's really laying the groundwork, foundational groundwork for anything and everything that comes later.
At its core, as you familiarized yourself with the medical education world as a director of admissions, at its core, what would you say is the role of an admissions committee?
That's a really good question. And I think at its core is to guarantee as much as possible for the individual medical school, certainly, and then in a larger sense for medicine in general. It is to be the gatekeeper. It is to say, we want to make sure, number one, that this applicant is going to be appropriate for our institution, is going to connect in terms of fit, is going to be successful and in our curriculum, and is well suited for being a physician in the sort of greater sense of things. And this really plays out when you consider that, for example, law school, the attrition rate is, 40, 50%. Typically, whereas for most medical schools in the United States, the attrition rate is like 2%. And so, what this says is that the admissions committees in general are doing a good job of making sure that the students are going to be a good fit for the profession as well as for their institution.
I don't think I heard at all during that discussion you say our job is to make sure we get the students with the highest GPA and the highest MCAT score.
Nope. It's not, it's really not about that. It is about the ability for the student to be successful And I think in the curriculum, certainly, but also interpersonally with their peers, with the faculty, with the patients, and then later on, whether it's in residency or whether it's in their career, being able to see the patient as primary and to be well suited to helping those patients live a life and die a death that is honorable.
Yeah. From the time you were the director of admissions at UT Southwestern, you had a stint at UT Dallas as a dean, setting up pre-health office and all that fun stuff, running a pre-health office. You then moved over to the executive director of TMDSAS, where you got to interface with all of the medical schools that interacted with and used TMDSAS. What have you seen in terms of any sort of changes along the medical school application process? And the one thing that comes to mind for me, where we're talking about stats, is I think that's a relatively newer, at least on the surface, thing to say. Maybe 30 years ago, you could get in with a 4.0 GPA and a near perfect MCAT score without a lot of other things, because we didn't really have the data. We weren't really thinking through the soft skills and the bedside manner, and we just had a lot of assumptions around the smartest people make the best doctors, and we're like, well, maybe not. And smartest meaning GPA, MCAT, because those are the only two things we could measure. Are my assumptions wrong there, that that's one of the big changes, and what other changes potentially have you seen over the years?
Yeah, I mean, the changes I've seen run the gamut. Some of them are super practical. When I first started at UT Southwestern, we were still in the paper, the
Paper
MCAT was
application.
the paper application, the MCAT was, you go and you take it in a room and you're bubbling in the question, the
I
answers.
took a paper MCAT.
Yeah. And so practically speaking, a lot of changes in terms of the MCAT and how it's taken, changes in terms of how a student applies and what they have to do to apply. And we would get these from TMDSAS weekly. We would get these giant boxes full of paper applications. And we would make file folders for every application, and we had all this bank of filing cabinets. And so that is a super sort of practical example. But I think that I agree that back in the 90s, which is when I started at Southwestern, aging myself there, that it was, I think that there was a recognition then that the MCAT and GPA aren't sufficient to identify somebody who's going to be a good doctor. They can identify somebody who's going to be good as a student, in terms of the cognitive knowledge, the cognitive so abilities, but it doesn't really do anything to say anything about how they're going to be when they're walking in that patient's room and interacting with that patient. And back in the old days, and when I say old days, I'm talking about the 60s, the 1960s and 70s, the MCAT had what was called a general knowledge section. And it was stuff like, it would have a question about pop culture, and you had to, you had to, answer this question about pop culture or geography or,
Weird.
yeah. And if you think about it, there's two sides to that. One is, in a way, it was testing awareness of the world around you, awareness of what's going on, and just sort of like, as it suggests, just general sort of knowledge. The other side to that, it was very, could be filled with bias, and against, if you were somebody who was raised in a house that paid attention to pop culture, then you would benefit from that. If you were somebody who was from a rural area that didn't have a television and didn't have a, you know, very, very much to go on in terms of pop culture, then you were enormously disadvantaged.
Yeah.
So I think that it's sort of a hit or miss with that. But I do think that there's something to be said for testing emotional intelligence and how a student can be effective in a interpersonal relationship, which is what the doctor-patient relationship is all about.
Yeah. I know you love doing mock interviews with students who sign up and do mock interviews with the MAPT team. What is it about interacting with pre-med students and seeing kind of the joy on their face, the excitement about going to medical school that drives you?
Oh, it's so, you know, my experience with students over the years has routinely been exciting and exhilarating. And part of that comes from the passion that the students have. They, in most cases, they've worked toward this end for many years, or they've thought about it for many years. In some cases, it's a more recent thing. But, you know, I would say typically students have been thinking about this for a long time and working toward it. And they're passionate about wanting to be a physician for all the right reasons. And so that is exciting to me. I like to see somebody in general that's passionate about whatever they're passionate about.
Yeah.
You know, you need to be passionate about something. And whether that's football or whether that's, you know, I'm sorry to bring up football, by the way, Ryan.
I was lost
on Saturday.
I was at the game when they lost.
Oh my gosh.
It stung. That's all right.
But you know, I think, you know, we need to have passion in our lives. And I love it that these students are passionate and that they are filled with just the anticipation for doing what they've wanted to do for
Yeah. We work with a lot of students. We talk with a lot of parents of those students. Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think, I mean, going back to what we were just talking about a little bit earlier, the focus on stats is still primary for a lot of students and especially parents, right? If you're talking directly to the parents right now, what do you want to tell them about, like, let your student do other things, not just focus on grades?
Yeah, I think parents are, you know, and not exclusively, but I think parents are often really focused on grades. They're focused on rankings. They're focused on trying to hurry it along in terms of the getting to the destination, and I just think that's a disadvantage to the student. I think when you're hyper focused on the metrics, which is sort of ironic because this, you know, we all lament the idea that we're so focused on the metrics, and yet the parents as the support network in many cases for these students, they're themselves pushing the students toward that end or that metric end of things. And so I would say to parents is let your student do it. Let your student be involved. You need to sort of take a back seat. Guidance is of course important.
Yeah.
And moral support is obviously very important. But I think that parents, and being a parent myself, it is very difficult to sort of let that student, you know, out of the nest and let them kind of sink or swim, and you know, and but you have to do that.
Yeah, we have gone through a period where parents don't like letting their kids fail.
No.
And I think that is a failure of all by itself.
Yeah. You know, I had a student one time that I was interviewing, and the question I asked the student was, tell me about a time when you were told, no, you cannot do that. And what did you get out of that? And the student was like a deer in the headlights. And this particular student, I don't know that they had ever been told no to anything.
Yeah.
They were top of their class in high school. They were top of their class in college. They were, you know, they'd done it all and been successful at everything. But it said something to me, you know, as humans, I think there's a benefit and we learn a lot about ourselves when we fail at something, when we can't do it or we're told, sorry, you can't do that.
Yeah.
We learn a lot about what life is about and how you respond and roll with that. And that's why the medical schools really emphasize resilience and adaptability. And because, you know, sooner or later, you're going to hear no,
whatever it is.
Yeah. And so how you deal with that is super important.
Yeah. We had our youngest in a daycare where the teachers would get in trouble if they told the kids no. They were allowed to redirect, but you couldn't say no. I'm like, but life, right?
Yeah,
life.
Yeah, right.
That's terrible. So the pre-med students that you work with, that you as the VP of Academic Advising help our other advisors work with, if you could highlight like two or three things that you're seeing that our other advisors are seeing day in and day out of like, you need to fix this, you need to fix this, you need to fix this. What do you think those top things would be?
Yeah, I think that language is a very important thing. And by language, what I mean is the ability to communicate, whether that's in writing or orally. I think that's really important. And I'll give you a couple examples. We routinely find students whose writing abilities are really not great.
Yeah.
And not just the use of grammar, but I'm talking about communicating their thoughts in writing in a way that makes sense for somebody who's reading it, who doesn't know them, has never met them, and is trying to understand their story and what it's been about. So I think writing, communication in writing is important, and communication orally. I'll give you a good example. I interviewed a student, did a mock interview with a student several weeks ago, who used the word like consistently in his responses. And it was so distracting that I ended up at one point counting. I asked him a question and I kept a little slash marks on my pad that I had in front of me. And in the one response that he gave to that one question, he said the word like 34 times.
Wow.
And so we talked about it afterwards.
Yeah.
And I think what we have in our culture our culture has become very casual.
Yes.
And in a lot of different ways. And I'm not suggesting that's a bad thing necessarily, but I think that has crept into our language and the ability for us to communicate in a way that's effective and that's appropriate.
Yeah.
And so what I would say is, that's another example of students sort of being self-aware and being able to generate a means of communication that's going to be effective.
Yeah. We have different, at least I, and I think in general, humans have different kind of gears that we can shift into when I'm doing a podcast or when we're live streaming, answering questions, my F-bombs don't fly left and right.
Right.
Casually, I cuss like a sailor and that's just who I am. And I like doing it. It's whatever. And so do my kids. And maybe that's a little bad, but hey, whatever. when they start using cuss words appropriately, you're like, yeah, I'm a good parent.
Yeah. Right.
But I have a switch. Right. When I'm on microphone, I don't do that stuff anymore.
Right.
How does someone practice? I mean, is it literally just that? Is it just practice to go, okay, I'm now in a more professional setting. I need to get away from my hanging out with my friends conversation and tone.
Yeah, I think it's two things. I think number one, it's intentionality.
Yeah.
It is you have to intentionally, and secondarily, it's self-awareness. You have to be aware, number one, of who you are and how you communicate and how you know, whether that's through nonverbal communication or whether it's through, the words that you're saying and the inflection of your voice. But you have to be aware of what your tendencies are, what your, do I tend to speak too quickly, or do I spend, tend to speak too softly or too loudly or whatever. But then intentionality is knowing, being self-aware and knowing what my tendencies are or what I do in regular everyday language. What's appropriate? It's also about emotional intelligence. It's about being able to judge the character in the room that you're in and the setting, and appropriately be able to respond to those cues and to those to the prompt, whether it's an interview or whether it's a patient encounter or whether you're at a coffee shop with a friend having a good time, recognizing that sometimes you adjust. So it takes those things, self-awareness and intentionality. And to further the story that I told about the student that said like a lot, when we discussed that, he was very, shocked and concerned and aware. And literally a week later, we did another mock interview, and he did not use the word like one time.
Wow.
And he had been practicing, practicing, practicing with his friends at ball games and, just in daily life. He had been really, really intentional in terms of making that change.
Yeah.
And to his credit, he did a great job of it.
Yeah, I was just a couple days ago at University of Florida at the Kentucky game watching them lose, but I was there because the Career Connections Center and the pre-health office invited me to keynote an event during a mock interview, kind of group interview, MMI practice session they did for students during who are in the interview cycle now or application cycle. And that came up all the time. The students were doing their mock interview. The advisors giving the feedback would say, "Hey, you're saying an awful lot." And they would look at me and I'm like, "Really?" And I love the word intentionality because that's the word that I use all the time. It's just the being intentional about every single word leaving your mouth. It's not as hard as it
It's
seems.
not.
You just
It's not.
slow down just the tiniest
Slow
bit
down.
and you go, "Oh, it's that easy." So it really is just first the self-awareness, right? Which is why we tell people whether you're doing a mock interview with us, whether you're doing it alone, whether you're doing it with your pre-health advisor, record yourself audio and video so you can watch yourself, so you can hear yourself and have someone sit down and give you that feedback to say, "Hey, did you know?" Blah, blah, blah. And having that ability to go, "Okay, now I see it. Now I hear it. Now let me stop it." And that stopping part is really the easiest part once you're aware of it.
I agree. I totally agree with that, and I think that it is a sense of we don't want we typically don't think as we talk. It's weird to say that, but I think we get in this sort of zone where we're just kind of the words are just coming out, and it really is about thinking about every word that you are saying and being intentional. And that's where exactly what you said, slowing down. And I'm not talking about going really slow, but I'm just slowing down enough to where you're listening to yourself talk.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
So when it comes to let's talk about specifically for students who are very early on in their process. A lot of them aren't sure where to go, what they're doing, if they're on the right track. We have mapped out software that hopefully all of them are signing up for because they can get a nice customized roadmap and map out their own journey to med school or PA school or wherever. But students who potentially don't know what they don't know. And I was right. talking about this a lot this weekend. I spoke at four different schools in 4 days, which was crazy, driving all over Florida. and one of the conversations I had was technically a kind of like, I was a first generation student. I never really used that sort of language before, but I was ignorant to a lot of the process and what it took to get into medical school, what it took to get into the residency that I wanted as an orthopedic surgeon. I didn't know the weight that the MCAT had on medical school admissions, whatever. How do students start figuring that stuff out if they don't know and they don't know to ask questions to figure it out?
Yeah. I think that number one, I would say that to me, the hallmark of an educated person is knowing what you don't know. If you don't know what you don't know, that's big time problematic.
Yeah.
It's hugely problematic for a physician who doesn't know what they don't know.
Yeah.
Because that creates all kinds of problems. So I think developing the sense of, I don't know at all, I know very little. And really using that to be able to chart out, you know, what am I going to do in the next few days, weeks, months, years, whatever. But what I would say is, you know, we grow up here in the United States. The vast majority of our applicants are U.S. citizens who grew up in the U.S. We do have international students, and we do have first-generation Americans. But I would say the vast majority have grown up in this culture. And we live in a culture that is very individualistic. It is very, you know, I'm going to pull myself up by my bootstraps, and I'm going to, you know, be successful, and I'm responsible for me, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that what we have to do as educators, and what a student has to do as a part of that educational process, is to recognize that this is not a go it yourself alone kind of mentality, kind of enterprise. And you have to, if a student will set the groundwork saying, I know that I don't know everything, and that as an individual, I can't do this alone. I need a support network for my family and friends. And I also need advisors who are going to help me in this process. Mm-hmm. And so I reach out to the advisors, even when I know, or I think I know the right answer, then I have to reach out to verify that, to confirm that that is accurate. And that is, I think, a part of what can begin the process for a early on type of student to be able to do this in a way that's gonna get them where they want to go.
Yeah. I was talking about my journey and to these students, and I said one of the biggest things. Number one, I said I don't think, me personally, think that being a first generation student is a quote unquote good enough excuse about a lack of knowledge, especially mm-hmm. today when we have supercomputers in our pockets for the most part, right?
Yeah, right.
And it's not to say that first gen students don't have obstacles and barriers and lots of things. That's not what I'm saying.
Right.
But I think if we can just start with, and I was trying to figure out a way to help them understand what to do. And I was thinking about it. And I think just having the ability to be inquisitive, which is a very good trait to have as a doctor, the ability to say, okay, I'm a senior in high school. I'm a first year in undergrad. I want to go to medical school. Let me pull up this website called Google and say, what do first year students need to know about going to medical school? And right. Google that, and then find something and then Google that, and then find something, and then Google that, and just go down the rabbit hole until you think you've answered a lot of questions. And of course, there's going to be more out there, but that will probably give you more information than I had all of going through undergrad,
because
we didn't have that. I didn't have that stuff growing up. Thankfully, I'm not as old as you are, but it's I still didn't have. We had flip phones back then, and we didn't have the internet as it is today, which is phenomenal resource that everyone has. And of course, our podcasts and our weekly live Q&As that we do together as a mapped team, which is awesome. And then obviously our software that we put out and one-on-one advising sessions if someone can invest in those. So I mean, there's no excuses anymore for not having answers, because we have so much information out there, both as a company ourselves, but also just the internet and Google being able to, and YouTube.
Well, I agree with that completely. And the caveat I would add to that is always seeking confirmation.
Yes.
Particularly when you're doing a lot of Google searching, and you know, there's the benefit of the supercomputer in our pocket is that we have the world at our fingertips. The downside to that is there's a lot of crap out there that is not accurate or that is misleading or whatever. And so it really requires us to be able to recognize and seek confirmation from advisors and from others that can really help you know what's what.
Yeah. Or just learning, right? I think this should be part of elementary education these days.
Yeah,
my daughter was in the back seat recently. We were driving as a family somewhere, and she goes, "Oh, I forgot. I was supposed to look up how much water the human has in its body." And so she had my wife's phone, and she knows how to use an iPhone. And she went to Safari and Googled it, and she was like, "Oh, 75%." And so I asked, "I'm like, well, where did you get that knowledge? Where did you get that number?" And I was trying to explain to her, like, just because you found a number online doesn't mean it's true. And so how do you learn to just be very discerning about all of that and ask follow-up questions? Go, okay, I see you said 75. Let me look through the article and see where you're sourcing your information from. And let me go to them, and let me see where they're sourcing it from. Let me go to them. And then you finally get to the end where it's like, hey, a study of 40,000 people said the average whatever water that the body has is 75%. Here's how we got to that number. Great.
Yeah.
I'm good. I can believe that number.
Yep.
And being able to learn how to do that. And even as physicians, I think the biggest thing that I learned in medical school wasn't the knowledge specifically. It was learning how to ask the questions to find the knowledge.
That's right.
And if we can start teaching that to younger and younger people, I think, number one, we'd probably have a lot less issues with misinformation online because people will be able to ask questions and go, that sounds a little weird. Let me do a little more research on that. I think it's important to know for everyone going through this process. How do you get those answers? And so one of the things that we do here at Mapped is we do a lot of one-on-one advising for someone, whether it's a student or a parent out there thinking about investing in advising with one of our wonderful advisors, or maybe with another advisor somewhere. Outside of their own advisor at their university, or maybe they don't have access to one. Where do you think is the line between I can do it myself with all of the amazing free resources that the MAP team puts out, or I want to invest in some one-on-one help?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a student has to be kind of, again, it goes back to self-awareness. It goes back to knowing yourself, being able to judge what capabilities you have. You know, I think that we all like to think that we have the wherewithal, whether it's financial wherewithal or whether it's cognitive wherewithal or whatever, to be able to trudge forward in a process. But I think all in all, what we're talking about here is, again, getting back to this notion that connection with other humans is important. If it's because I need to verify some information, it's because I need guidance. If it's because, whatever reason, connection with other humans is important. This is what teaches us and how to be good members of society and good, physicians, et cetera, because that's what a physician does is interact with people. And so I
Unless
think
you're a
that it's really,
pathologist.
yeah, well, that is true.
Just kidding, pathologists. I'm just kidding.
Well, they're interacting with people on a micro level. But in general, I think that that's what students need to get used to is that kind of thing.
Well, Dr. Scott writes, students can ask you questions most Wednesdays on our Asked MAP live stream we do at mapped.tv. That's MAPPD.tv. You also do one-on-one advising a little bit as you're the head honcho. And so you're busy helping all the other advisors as well. You're also a regular contributor to Application Academy, which is our group coaching. So there are lots of ways to connect with you through MAP. So what is one final word of wisdom that you want to give students as we wrap up here?
Good question. I think one final word of wisdom. I would say to try your best to be, and I don't want to use the word chill. I mean, I think we use that, kind of jokingly sometimes. I'll just chill out or whatever. But I think that students need to see what's occurring as a part of the give and take of life and of being in existence in this world. And just because something happens that you didn't anticipate doesn't mean the wheels are going to fall off or that your dream is dashed. It means, this is particularly true for reapplicants or for those that took the MCAT and didn't do as well as they wanted to do, or had a rocky first year or two in college, or there's a lot of reasons why you may need to reflect on that. But just kind of be thoughtful, be resilient in seeking this passionate part of your life, and keep working hard.
All right, so there you have it again, Dr. Scott Wright, the VP of Academic Advising at MAPT. Before we leave, though, I want to talk about the MCAT Minute brought to you by Blueprint MCAT. And I want to talk about MCAT registration. It's opening up soon. As this episode is coming out, it's the end of September. MCAT registration historically opens up beginning to mid of October every single year. The MCAT dates for next year just released. So this is the future, hello future, I hope the world is good. The MCAT dates typically come out near the end of September for the following year, and then registration opens up sometime kind of mid-October-ish. So that's when to stay tuned for MCAT dates. So that's an important thing. Start building your schedule using Blueprint MCAT's free schedule planning tool that you get with a free account over at blueprintmcat.com. Hope you have a great week. We'll see you next time here on the Pre-Med Years.
This is MedEd Media.